You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 30th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Robert Bounds. On today's show, veteran journalist Seymour Hersh goes off on one on the state of US media. George Brock and Matthew Jameson are here to assess the state of American journalism. And following Austria's weekend election, we'll meet the founders of a new think tank run by the under 40 demographic.
In Austria, we have a tendency that everyone who has opinion-making authority tended to be male and around 60 years old. Right now, it's the time to bring in new perspectives, especially the perspectives of the youngs.
And then?
We believe issuing travel advisory is counterproductive in the fight against global terrorism. We cannot and shall not allow terrorists to instill fear in our people.
Kenya asked the US to lift its travel warning on the country. We'll ask if that's a good idea. And later on in the show, we'll meet Andrew Renton, director of the Marlborough Contemporary Gallery, for coffee and a chat at the Monocle Cafe. All that, plus a little bit of music and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Robert Bounds, right now. Plenty to come, but before it does, it's news time with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. At least 47 people have been killed and many more injured in a series of car bombings in Baghdad. Police say the bombs were left in parked cars in Shia neighbourhoods. They hit outdoor markets and car parks. It's reported the deadliest bombing was in Sadr City neighbourhood, where at least seven people died after a bomb exploded near a place where labourers had gathered. It's not yet known who carried out the bombings. Up to 75 people are missing after three Chinese fishing boats sank in a powerful typhoon off the coast of Vietnam. Reports say the vessels were hit by strong winds near the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. 171 people in five boats were caught up in rough seas, whipped up by Typhoon Wutip. The storm is expected to make landfall in Vietnam's central region later. Authorities have ordered mass evacuation. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced major political reforms, which include new Kurdish rights. He's proposed lowering the 10% electoral threshold, which currently prevents Kurdish and other smaller parties from entering parliament. He says towns will be able to use their Kurdish rather than Turkish names. He also plans to end the ban on women public servants wearing headscarves, a long-standing goal of his party. Turkey has been struggling to join the European Union for several decades. The European Commission has welcomed Mr. Erdogan's announcement. Spokesman for the EU Enlargement Commission, Peter Stano, says they'll be monitoring the reforms.
I see this as a good intention to move forward and also to reconcile the differences with the rest of the world, meaning the Western world. It seems that the government and the Prime Minister is quite cognizant of the fact that a move towards democratization will also help reconciliation with the Kurds, who feel that they have been excluded and have been left out of the nationalization process.
Apologies, that was the Turkish academic Du Ercin. I'll bring you Peter Stano next time. With only hours to go before the midnight deadline to avert a US federal government shutdown, debate over Obamacare has resumed in Congress. Senior Senate Democratic aides have announced the chamber will take a simple majority vote shortly after 2 p.m. their time. That's about now. That will strip Republican amendments and send a clean funding bill back to the House of Representatives. The move throws a political hot potato back to Republican House Speaker John Boehner, leaving him a choice of whether to accept it and keep government agencies funded or try another move to rein in President Barack Obama's healthcare law. John Boehner insists representatives have played their part to avoid shutdown.
The House has done its work. We passed a bill on Saturday night, sent it to the United States Senate, that would delay Obamacare for 1 year and would eliminate permanently the medical device tax that is costing us tens of thousands of jobs that are being shipped overseas. Senate decided not to work yesterday. Well, my goodness, if there's such an emergency, where are they?
The Kenyan Red Cross says the number of missing people after Al-Shabaab militants stormed the Westgate shopping centre in Nairobi on the 21st of September has gone down to 39 from an earlier figure of 61. Officials say 14 of the missing have been found alive and 7 bodies were in the morgue. The Red Cross says some relatives had not been updating them when they found people who'd been reported missing. Defence lawyers have demanded forensic evidence be re-examined in the retrial of 2 suspects over the 2007 murder of British student Meredith Kircher in Florence. American Amanda Knox and her Italian boyfriend Raffaele Sollicito were found guilty but acquitted on appeal in 2011. But that ruling was overturned in March by Italy's highest court amid strong criticism of the way the appeals court had dismissed important DNA evidence. The suspects have always insisted they are innocent. Neither of them is in court. Austria's 2 ruling parties have won enough votes for another 5-year term in what's referred to as a grand coalition. However, it was their worst result since World War II. There was a surge in support for the Eurosceptic right-wing Freedom Party, which gained 2.4% of the vote. Social Democrats came top with 27.1% and the Conservative People's Party got 23.8% in Sunday's election. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. This is Aperitivo. It's Monocle 24. We'll be back in a second.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, vada City Cheche.
From London,
London. London, Caracas.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And that was the Tower of Babel. Welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is 2:07 in the morning in Tokyo. It's 18:07 here in London, making it 13:07 lunchtime in New York City. It's time for us now to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me in the studio is George Brock, head of journalism at City University and author of the new book, Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. Also by my side is Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the London based think tank RUSI. Chaps, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
So today we're talking about the small matter of the state of American journalism. Over the weekend, in a long interview with the Guardian newspaper here in the UK, veteran American journalist Seymour Hersh lambasted the current state of the American media establishment. The Republic's in trouble, he said. We lie about everything. Lying has become the staple. And he laid into many other bits and bobs and pieces. I'm sure both of you, if you weren't there at the lecture, because this was sort of taken as notes from a lecture that he delivered. Wonder what you thought of his of maybe a couple of his more potent broadsides on Obama, particularly. George, what did you think of the vibe of Seymour Hersh's speech?
Well, Cy Hersh's vibe is lambasting people. It's what he does
his,
for a living.
That's his shtick, right?
Actually, to be fair, he does 2 things. In conversation, he lambastes people. When he writes as an investigative journalist, he adopts a completely different mode. It is thorough, factual, extremely precise. It's why he's a devastatingly good investigative journalist. But as an individual, he has very strong political views. He's a Democrat who is very, very bitterly disappointed by what Obama has done. And this interview happens to be, was developed from a lecture actually at my university.
Yeah.
And this is him letting off steam about how bitterly he feels about Obama and drones and all sorts of other things. And he doesn't like the way that political journalists, you know, report on power. Well, Cy Hersh has never really liked that. And he's never really adjusted to the fact that there's a very big variety in journalism. Let's put it that way.
I'll tell you what he said about Obama. He said the New York Times has spent, and this is the quote, so much more time carrying water for Obama than I ever thought they would. Matthew, is that sort of fair comment? There is a lot of goodwill still left in the world in the center and center left press, in the Democratic press in the US for Obama, right? Yes,
I think so. I think it is a fair comment. Because if you go back to the 2008 campaign,
If you will recall, the traditionally Democrat supporting media, the liberal media in America, were very, very keen on Obama and very, very enthusiastic. And they really didn't give him the same type of scrutiny or attention that they leveled at Hillary Clinton. And Mrs. Clinton had to deal with quite a lot of media and a very strong probing of her record and her personality and so on. But they sort of glossed over President Obama. Indeed, I remember in 2007, there was a debate in late October where Mrs. Clinton got into a lot of trouble over whether or not a certain amnesty should be granted to illegal immigrants' driving licenses, I think it was, in New York State. And she got herself into a terrible kerfuffle, and all the other candidates attacked her for being, you know, this was the typical sort of Clintonian triangulation. Obama made the same mistake, the same gaffe in the next debate, and there wasn't any real coverage picked up in the media about this. So I think it is a fair point that, yes, a lot of the U.S. media, especially sort of the New York Times and so on, has been carrying a lot of water for President Obama over these last few years.
George has put his finger up and wants to make a point on that. Is the leveling, was that playing field level, at least in the the election?
No, I think Matthew's absolutely right. The playing field was not remotely level when Obama was first elected. But what I was going to say was, I think one of the things Cy Hirsch is doing is he's really proving to us that American political culture is still living in the shadow of 9/11. 9/11 is a long time ago now, but it is still incredibly difficult for any American politician or even prominent journalist to say, we've got this enormous military security apparatus, and sometimes things go wrong. Because that is actually what Hirsch has done in his journalism career. He was the man who exposed a massacre in Vietnam. He was the man who said prisoners are being maltreated in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And he was right about both of these things. Events proved him to be completely right. And he is not anti the American military establishment. He just says that if you have an absolutely enormous military establishment, you've got to really stay on your toes because stuff goes wrong. People do bad things.
And someone's going to press, if not the button, a button accidentally, at least some of the time.
There is that risk.
there's this book about nuclear proliferation and the bomb cut that's recently come out, which makes for terrifying reading. We're not going to get sidetracked on that.
Cy Hirsch may criticize a lot of journalists, but my guess is he liked that book a lot.
Yeah, I expect he did. In terms of that, he said in the lecture that any American leader, because we are still in the shadow of 9/11. Can just cry Al Qaeda every time that people are worried that we're spying on the Brazilian president, for example, or that we're keeping the government keeps our emails in some huge computer cache, that he can just say, well, security, it's a national security thing. But we don't want to get bogged down entirely on Obama. I have a question for both of you, George. You first, as you're a teacher of journalism. You've just brought this book out, which chimes perfectly, if only in the title, with what we're discussing. Are American papers good enough? Are they a bit boring? I mean, British newspapers seem to do a different job, but maybe that's just me kind of wishing that there was a little bit more interesting, a little bit more splashiness, maybe in American papers.
One of the problems that American journalists had was a lot of the newspapers in the 1950s and 60s became monopolies. TV knocked out the weaker newspapers in America, right? Everybody thinks the internet is killing newspapers. Nothing like the same number of newspapers have died in the internet era as died when television became big in America. The 1950s and the 60s, that was the time when newspapers died, really in big numbers. Cities became one newspaper cities. Newspapers had to appeal to everyone. They found very attractive the idea about impartiality, neutrality, and so on. So opinion, strong opinion, kind of came out of the American journalistic mix. Come the internet in the 1990s.
So it's for that reason, that's an interesting thing, because I always thought it was because America has become such a legal culture that you couldn't say anything without being sued for saying it.
Not really, no. No. It began because you were trying to appeal to very big audiences and you wanted lots and lots of advertisers to not think you so spiky or opinionated that they weren't going to buy space in your paper. That was the basic reason. Come the internet, what happens in American journalism? Hey, it suddenly gets really vulgar, excitable, trashy. What other people call down market suddenly came back. One of the most successful businesses in internet journalism in New York is Gawker.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they have started to do serious journalism. So has BuzzFeed. Neither of those sites began with any remotely kind of serious journalistic intentions of holding power to account, although they may now go into that business. So, you know, there have been a lot of very sudden changes. Philosophy, you know, disruption moves in unpredictable ways. It's what happens in a disruption.
And what I want to know from both of you also then is, Seymour Hersh is 76. He's also got a book coming out. Is he? He's obviously trying to throw a fairly large boulder into the rock of if not international, then U.S. journalism. But I wonder how justified you think he is, Matthew, in doing that. Whether he's just saying it was better in my day. Mm. He's a man with a couple of huge journalistic scoops and a Pulitzer Prize under his belt. Is he just an old man saying it was better when I was doing it?
Well, I think there is an element of that. I think that he's being a little bit too harsh, actually, on American newspapers, because actually I think probably some of the top American broadsheets are far better than anything we have in this country, quite frankly. I mean, we really simply don't have something like the New York Times in Britain. We don't. I mean, the quality of top British broadsheet journalism has just really collapsed. The Times is rubbish. It's full of absolute trivial nonsense. The Guardian, the same. The Telegraph, the same. The only good one left is probably the Financial Times. And it's the only one where you can get really great coverage of international affairs and the rest of the world and global strategy and op-eds and serious analysis of politics and policy. But the problem with the British newspapers is they've become so parochial. Our news coverage in this country, you would think everything revolved around Britain, and it doesn't anymore. And the reporting on some of the most mundane, banal things. I mean, in the Telegraph, there's barely any coverage of the outside world. They have very little foreign affairs. It's always, you know, the typical sort of...
Sometimes, Matthew, attractive blonde ladies from the home counties who love horses, sometimes they do get involved in rail crashes.
Well, indeed. No, absolutely, of course. But, you have to have a balance here. And also, there's so much celebrity rubbish now in the British newspapers and so much trivial tittle-tattle. And you pick up a copy of the Sunday Times, and it's like a lifestyle magazine. So I think that Hersh is being a little bit unfair in some of the American newspapers, because the quality is still very good in the New York Times or the Washington Post or even the Los Angeles Times and even indeed the Washington Times as well. And then you have things like Politico and George referenced BuzzFeed. And we don't have anything again like Politico in this country that's come up. But I do think that, yes, he is right, that overall the quality, I think, of journalism today, the journalists that are coming through are not as good as what some of the people that we saw in an earlier age.
Well, before we get into a debate about the scurrilousness of British journalism and the sobriety of American journalism, I'd like to ask you, George, a thing that came up in Seymour Hersh's speech was he was obviously famous for being a campaigning journalist, not necessarily on purpose. It's just that a couple of things became campaigns. They became things that other people jumped on the bandwagon for, and rightly so. He mentioned that people these days were possibly glory hunters, that there was a sort of hegemony or homogeneity of journalism, because lots of people kind of wanted to, I think he mentioned railway crossings, that if people want to make them safe, then they think that might make them a Pulitzer Prize winner, because it's a sort of piece of campaigning journalism rather than getting out there, wearing out your shoe leather, making 100 phone calls a day and making a nuisance of yourself.
Well, Seymour Hersh was very lucky. He began doing journalism in a time when spending 6 months finding one document or one big story was actually a feasible thing to do. We can't deny that in the background with a lot of these papers, that's now much, much harder. They just don't have the economic space to do it. That's one of the things that's been happening for the last 30 or 40 years. Print actually began to decline as a business really quite early on in the post-war era. It was made worse by the internet.
So because we always look at it, it's an interesting thing you said about about TV coming in. That was the killer, not the internet. We still maybe look at it fondly, we still look at it, the internet, in a different way.
It's been a series of hammer blows. You know, the Daily Mirror in Britain had its highest circulation in 1966. Yeah. Aggregate national circulations in Britain started to decline in the early 1950s. There's been radio, there's been TV, then the satellite TV, then there's cable TV, then there's the internet. Every single one of those has squeezed these pressures, and it's made investigative journalism harder. But investigative journalism, among a lot of other things, is flourishing in different places. People are starting freestanding things to do it. Seymour Hersh actually complained in his interview about how newspapers weren't following the drones war. Well, we host at my university one of the outfits called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is one of the three places in the world which actually does track who gets killed by drones. And so other people are doing these things. Investigative journalism actually isn't in as terrible a state as I would be more worried about the state of arts and literary journalism in some ways than I would be about investigative journalism. The number of philanthropists who are prepared to support new things to keep investigative journalism going one way and another is quite decent. The number of people who want to keep arts and literary journalism going seems to me distressingly small.
Yeah, well, this is a whole other ball game. It's perhaps slightly closer to my heart, that one is. But I guess it's the fact that you might not see this campaigning journalism within the pages, the paper pages of a newspaper, but you will click on something. There is something more immediate to it. What about you, Matthew? I wondered what you thought of this idea of campaigning, of the campaign journalism. How important is that to you as a part of a think tank? How often does a piece of something you read change your view on something?
You mean campaigning journalism as in...
Campaigning journalism in terms of possibly the WikiLeaks scandal, in terms of possibly Snowden's sort of revelations about intelligence.
Sure. Yes, that's a very interesting area. It's one that what you have to really wrestle with about freedom of press and freedom of expression, but also the balance with national security and intelligence that is classified. I personally feel as though that, you know, the WikiLeaks, I don't really see how, you know, the service of just, you know, dumping highly classified...
That's far from the definition of campaigning journalism. Yeah, well, yeah. But I suppose, a wodge of truth.
You like Glenn Grunwald's things about... it started off with an interesting angle that I think a lot of us would like, which was about the surveillance aspect of it. But again, you know, we're not getting the full picture here. And we can't get the full picture because intelligence is a very murky, dangerous, difficult business. And a lot of it is not meant for public consumption. It's not meant to be seen in the public. But a lot of it plays a great part in preserving our security. So I think that there are ethical issues that journalists like Glenn Grunwald have to wrestle with. Certainly some of the stories that have been seeping out from the Snowden thing recently, I don't see what relevance they have to anything to do with the surveillance. This is about traditional intelligence gathering, like the United States spying on the Pakistani government, and things like that I don't think should be in the public domain.
I've got one last question on this topic. We're going to change our horses in midstream in a sec. But George, what was your take on this? And I wonder what your students rather take on Cy Hirsch's talk was. This was at your university. Did lots of people want to ask you questions and wonder why on earth they were studying this thing, or were they a bit pissed off by it and thought that they could be the next generation?
No, I don't think so. I think that obviously for them, Vietnam is a kind of historical event back there with Queen Victoria. So it was kind of, you know, he was casting back to the past. But he did Abu Ghraib. They know what that was. And they are respectful towards his most serious point, which is somehow, not easy, you've got to find space to do some of it very slowly. What we used to call in newsrooms slow wheel journalism.
Yeah.
Somehow you've got to find the space to do that because there are some discoveries that people don't want you to make and they're only going to be made by extremely patient shoe leather.
Shoe leather's the thing. See, we always go back to that. I kind of like the idea of that. I feel like it's a filmic image as well. We're going to take a short break. You're tuned in to Aperitivo with Robert Bound. We'll be back with George Brock and Matthew Jameson in a second. Up next, we're talking about travel bans in Kenya and whether they should be implied, whether they shouldn't be implied, what the wording should be, and all the rest of it. It's 1823 here in London. We'll be back in a sec.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is George Brock from City University and author of the new book Out of Print, and Matthew Jameson from London-based think tank RUSI. Now we're going to change tack. After the bloody attack by Al-Shabaab militants on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi 8 days ago, the US government issued a travel warning advising American citizens not to travel to the East African country. Kenya, however, is not happy. Here is their interior minister.
The advisory was issued despite the fact that we had asked the United States government, as a friendly country, not to issue such an advisory. We believe issuing travel advisory is counterproductive in the fight against global terrorism. We cannot and shall not allow terrorists to instill fear in our people. And so we request the United States, as a friendly country to Kenya, to lift the travel advisory.
And that was Kenya's interior minister on this travel ban that the US has imposed. Matthew, is putting this thing, do you think this does more harm than good? Is this a bit of a paranoid act?
I don't think so. I think it's just a precaution, really. I don't see how any responsible government that cares for the well-being of its citizens after a terrible terrorist attack like this could not advise their citizenry to beware of maybe avoiding that place or to taking extra security precautions if you're going there. It is, of course, annoying for developing countries that are trying to build themselves up, of course, that are less well-established than, say, Britain. I don't think that there was too much of a travel warning after 7/7. But it's a different sort of application when it comes to more established countries.
There's a bit of a thing of a country being sort of having its tourism industry penalised for one act of violence, isn't there, George? Is it a matter of the wording of these things as well? That a real blanket, laying a blanket over the 747s, over the runway in the airport, is a little bit harsh?
No, I don't think it is. I think there are politicians on every continent who suddenly strike you as if they're living in a kind of parallel universe, and that's where I think the Kenyan Interior Minister is. I cannot believe that he genuinely thinks that countries like the United States can't, and indeed others, probably wouldn't put out some kind of warning. There's a $1 billion a year tourist industry in Kenya. A lot of people from America come to that from Britain. Go to Kenya on holiday, and it isn't a one-off, excuse me. This is not the first time terrorism has happened in Kenya. And indeed, a lot of these advisories are because people sit down with the record over time and say, was that a one-off, or actually is there a pattern here? Well, it seems to me fairly plain there's some kind of pattern. I think it's grossly... I mean, people take it very seriously if governments don't warn their citizens now that there are dangerous places. Now, we may consider that's mollycoddling. Well, some people might think it was mollycoddling people, but I don't. I think a government would be derelict in its duty if it wasn't warning people.
Presumably, these are the people as well. Presumably, putting a warning out is the fact that not everybody has got rolling news on. People don't necessarily wake up with the news headlines in the morning. And this message needs to be put across in quite an old-fashioned public information style warning, right?
Politicians and journalists live in a bubble where they think everybody is as well informed as they are. Well, they're simply not. Mm-hmm. They just don't listen to the news all the time. I had my hair cut once for a bloke who was going on holiday to Greece. After a few minutes of conversation, it turned out he had absolutely no idea where Greece was at all. He just went on a holiday somewhere where it was sunny, you could pick up girls, and the drink was reasonably cheap, and it didn't take you many hours to get there. As far as he was concerned, it could have been anywhere. It could really have been anywhere. Now, that kind of guy does actually need to know that the government says it's very undesirable to go to place X, go to place Y, because we think on balance, average, it's safer. We don't guarantee it. It just seems to us the odds are better.
This is an interesting point, the fact that journalists and politicians do live in this sort of bubble. Mm-hmm. Matthew, what's your sort of reading of, I was interested in the language of both of these sorts of things, mm-hmm. of the sort of language of the way that these things are put out, because it isn't a ban necessarily, it is a strong advice, strong advice not to.
Yes, right? Exactly. I mean, it's at the end of the day, the individual, the adult citizen is left up to make his or her own decision. So it's not so draconian that governments are clamping down and saying you can't can't go to this place. But I mean, I agree completely with George. And I think that, you know, any government would it'd be a dereliction of duty. And the language is very important because it has to be put out in a fashion that the average punter gets and hears. Like you said, you know, there is this disconnect between the very highly informed, highly connected world of politicians and journalists and then the general public that don't follow these events very closely. A lot of them probably wouldn't even maybe been aware that there had been, you know, this terrorist attack in Kenya. So I think that it is important that governments have to be clear with their citizens on these types of matters.
All right, gentlemen, we are going to leave it there. It's coming down to the bottom of the hour. That was George Brock and Matthew Jameson. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Plenty to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk modern art with Matt Andrew Renton of Marlborough Contemporary, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. Before we get started on that, we're going to have a short break and then the news with Bill Bingham.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
옷 런던, 두바이 모노클 24.
프라 런던, 베트 아이 모노클 24.
품 런던, 베세 런던,
올란다,
런던, 런던으로부터
홍콩, 홍콩,
쥬리,
런던,
런던. This is Monocle 24.
And at 18:30 here in London, Bill Bingham has the news headlines.
At least 47 people have been killed and many more injured in a series of car bombings in Baghdad. Police say the bombs, which were left in parked cars in Shia neighbourhoods, hit outdoor markets and car parks. It's reported the deadliest bombing was in the Sadr City neighbourhood. Up to 75 people were missing after three Chinese fishing boats sank in a powerful typhoon off the coast of Vietnam. Reports say the vessels were hit by strong winds near the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. 171 people in five boats were caught in rough seas, whipped up by Typhoon Wutip. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced major political reforms which include new Kurdish rights. He's proposed lowering the 10% electoral threshold, which currently prevents Kurdish and other smaller parties from entering parliament. He says towns will be able to use their Kurdish rather than Turkish names. He also plans to end the ban on women public servants wearing headscarves, a long-standing goal of his party. With only hours to go before the midnight deadline to avert a US federal government shutdown, debate over Obamacare has resumed in Congress. The Senate has been voting in a vote that will strip Republican amendments and send a clean funding bill back to the House of Representatives. The move throws a political hot potato back to the Republican House Speaker John Boehner, leaving him a choice of whether to accept it and keep government agencies funded or try another way to rein in President Barack Obama's healthcare law. The Kenyan Red Cross says the number of missing people after Al-Shabaab militants stormed the Westgate shopping centre in Nairobi on the 21st of September has gone down to 39 from an earlier figure of 61. Officials say 14 of the missing have been found alive and seven bodies were in the morgue. The Red Cross says some relatives had not been updating them when they found people who'd been reported missing. Defence lawyers have demanded forensic evidence be re-examined in the retrial of two suspects over the 2007 murder of British student Meredith Kircher in Florence. American Amanda Knox and her Italian boyfriend Raffaella Sollicito were found guilty but acquitted on appeal in 2011. But that ruling was overturned in March by Italy's highest court amid strong criticism of the way the appeals court had dismissed important DNA evidence. Austria's two ruling parties have won enough votes for another five-year term in what's referred to as a grand coalition. However, it was their worst result since World War II. There was a surge in support for the Eurosceptic right-wing Freedom Party. They gained 21.4% of the vote. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill, and welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Each day on Aperitivo, we leave Studio One here at Midori House and head down to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street. On today's show, we meet Andrew Renton, art curator, writer, former professor, and of course, director of the Marlborough Contemporary Gallery here in London. It's the latest addition to the Marlborough Group of Galleries, opening in October of last year, and on the first anniversary, Andrew joins Monocle's David Pleasant at the cafe right now. David, take it away.
Thanks, Rob. So, Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Cafe and Aperitivo. If we could start, it's been 1 year since the launch of Marlborough Contemporary. How's it all gone? And maybe fill in the listener who hasn't come across your gallery yet.
Well, it's been an incredible, eventful year, very packed full of amazing shows, and shows that have been really a revelation for me. And it's a real privilege to work with this group of artists that we're trying to form over at the new gallery. Marlborough Contemporary, just to explain, is the newest Marlborough gallery, and there are Marlborough galleries all over the world, and there's even one in London, Marlborough Fine Art, and it's been here for 60 plus years. So we're the very, very new kid on the block, and our job is to really try and look at new things and trying to look at those things that are in the art world that may be a bit overlooked, that aren't necessarily in the mainstream consciousness in this country, but are extremely important internationally. So that's what we've been exploring in the first year.
And that seems very kind of pertinent to your own kind of personal interests as well. And you've been quoted as saying that you're interested in how things translate or do not translate in terms of artworks and artists. Maybe tell us about some of the surprises you've had or some things that you think really have translated better than you expected. Some artists that perhaps weren't so known of or part of the scene here in London and really have become a bit of a revelation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of our job is not only to rethink what happens in London, and I would absolutely say without hesitation that London is the most dynamic art scene in the world. And I think maybe once upon a time I might have fantasized that maybe New York was, but London seems really, really bedded in as a center with so many things going on. And yet... there are still things you can do. When we were opening up Marlborough Contemporary, people said to me, well, what can you show that hasn't been shown? And we opened with a Mozambican, South African, Portuguese artist who'd shown in every Biennale around the world, Angela Ferreira, hugely important artist, and yet had never had a solo show in the UK. At the moment, we just opened with a show by Diango Hernandez. He's from Cuba. He's incredibly important. He's part of a huge network of really, really interesting young artists around the world. He's in all of those international exhibitions, and yet he'd never done a solo show in the UK. Now, I wonder what that means. I wonder whether it's a reflection of us or whether it's a reflection of how the art world works. I suspect that when we think that we're being international and when we speak about being international from our perspective, we're sort of talking about London and New York. But actually, there's a much, much bigger art world, or as I like to define it, there are many, many different art worlds around the world, and we have to start to sort of pull them in. And then there is that point, your original point about, does it translate? And that's when it starts to become really interesting, because our job as a gallery, or my job as a curator, is to try to find a way of explaining complex art, rich art, that happens elsewhere, and find a way of letting it speak in a language that people can understand when it's here. That seems to be the job. The job actually isn't selling art. The job is actually translating the art and presenting it in a framework and in a new context.
Are there many obstacles, do you think, as a curator, if you're talking about that process of translating, and, you know, if you say, I want to show Diango Hernandez here in London, are people saying, are you crazy, or that should be in Sao Paulo, that's not for London, or are people open? Do you find, despite that kind of arrogance that comes with being the centre of the art world, is there still the openness and the willingness to try new things here in London?
Oh, I think there's definitely willingness to try new things here. And, of course, people are very connected. People all read the same art magazines. They all go and they all gravitate to the same art websites. So we all think that we're international. But the thing about art, and the thing that's very important not to forget, is that as much as you think you've seen Diango's work in a magazine, there's nothing that prepares you for the physicality, for the encounter with a real work of art. And that's why we do this rather cumbersome business of running an art gallery in a world of JPEGs. there's no escaping that. You need to have that. So we've had incredible support. And what you have is you have people who are kind of quiet fans, and they say, oh, it's fantastic to see his work here. That's, you know, because we are all travelers. You know, we all troop through the biennales and we go to the art fairs and so on. So we're very used to seeing a compendium of art that very often we can't see the wood for the trees. And so we may have seen the work of an artist, but we've never had the context for it. My job, our job, is to provide the context.
And it's relevant that you talk about traipsing through fairs. Marlborough Contemporary launched at roughly the same time as the Frieze Masters, so the kind of juxtaposition there. So you launched the Marlborough Fine Art launched with a contemporary unit, and Frieze, a contemporary unit, launched with a Masters, a fine art kind of institution that went down very well. Can you tell us about that kind of that link between, why is that? Is it just the market driving that? Is it practicality? Is it more efficient? Why has that happened now?
I think there's many reasons, and I think it's extremely interesting and exciting why those things have happened. Cynics will say it's just about market, because they will say that it's collectors becoming more conservative and gravitating towards blue chip art. Art that's tried and tested and has a market approval already. I think it's about something else. I think it's about trying to lock in contemporary art into the bigger picture. You know, I every now and then I wear another hat and I teach, and when you're teaching, you're always trying to get across the idea that art doesn't exist in isolation. It belongs to a very, very long trajectory of ideas, art history, if you like. That's why Frieze Masters exists, and it has to exist. And that's why it was such a success when it launched. It's fantastic because we start to see the resonance between, let's say, modern art and contemporary art. So, in fact, this year in Frieze Masters, we've decided to really literally take it at its word. And one of the Marlborough contemporary artists, Lawrence Kavanagh, is curating a solo stand in Frieze Masters of one of Marlborough Fine Art's great old, late, lamented artists, Victor Passmore. And Passmore was one of those really important artists from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, who influenced, literally influenced, a young student, Lawrence, when he's up there in Newcastle. And so we gave him a chance to try and piece something together. What that does is it links the new with the history that made it. So that, again, no art exists in isolation. And that's why we think we can do something very interesting in terms of linking, if you like, old Marlborough with new Marlborough. But it's more than that. It's about saying that no art exists on its own in isolation.
And finally, if we go back to Django Hernandez's works right now at the gallery, tell us a little bit about what we might expect. I've seen a few of the JPEGs that you mentioned. I haven't gone down in person. Tell us what we're in for.
Well, you'll be in for a big surprise, because in a way the JPEGs only tell you half the story. Most of the work consists of these large graphite drawings that took many, many months to make. But the most striking thing that you see in the middle of all of this pristine elegance of these drawings that are renderings of works of sculptures from the 1930s is a maquette, an architectural maquette in the middle of the room made out of cheese. This references a historical precedent. Castiglione made a maquette in the early 1940s out of cheese. It was a critique of fascism at the time. And here is this organic thing that changes. Every morning I come in and it's kind of sweating and molding and so on.
What's the smell like coming into the gallery?
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know whether we can advertise here, but it's Sainsbury's grade one, low smell, low flavor cheese. So it doesn't smell too bad.
Well, let's hope not. Andrew Renton, thank you very much. That was fantastic. And back to Rob.
Cheers, David. That was David Pleasant speaking to Andrew Renton, who is the Marlborough man. He's the founder of Marlborough Contemporary. And I expect we'll be bumping into him and having a glass of something during Frieze in a couple of weeks. Up next, we're meeting a think tank in Austria for the young crowd, the under 40s, that is. That's on Aperitivo. And we're coming to you live on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And it's 6:45 here in London. You're tuned into Aperitivo, and I'm Robert Bounds. Austria is a country dominated by old politicians and old models of power. While the country's conservatism has helped it sail through years of recession, pundits warn that that comfort may end unless younger people get their voices heard. Monocle's man in Austria, Alexei Korolev, has met with members of a Vienna-based think tank, which is trying to bring together decision makers under 40 years of age to discuss current issues.
Austria has seen none of the economic and social misery endured by peer European Union nations like Greece or Ireland. A recent United Nations study has called it the 8th happiest nation in the world. But deep inside, there is disgruntlement.
In Austria, we have a tendency that everyone who has opinion-making authority tended to be male and around 60 years old. Doesn't matter if it's in TV or in print media. It's right now it's the time to bring in new perspectives, especially the perspectives of the youngs.
Milo Tesla is the founder of Denkt at Her, a think tank aiming to engage Austrian youth in major public discussions.
There is a difficulty in for the generations, let's say the under 40 generations, they don't have a clear enemy as their parents and former generations had or were used to. There is no clear enemy, so distraction is the biggest enemy, but you can't fight it.
There are, of course, other problems, says Denkt at Her member Virgil Guggenberger.
We have problems that are now are not really being discussed. Now we're talking about pensionen, like what do I get when my job is done when I'm 70? We have to deal with it. We have, work every day, of course, but there's not to be sure I'm going to work in the same company for 10 years, so what I'm going to do, so I have to change, I have to adapt. So that's the thing. It's a different lifestyle by now.
And although conservative centrist parties retained their majority in last weekend's parliamentary elections, Guggenberger says the vote may not be all that important in the long run.
The elections are a way to talk about it. So that's a good aufhänger. It's a good point to start.
Denkt.at ist eine Initiative.
Denkt.at steht für eine neue Art zu denken.
Es geht darum, einer jüngeren Generation.
The subject of much television attention, Denkt.at principally consists of 30 thinkers who are running regular columns in 5 daily newspapers. Katrin Klöckl is overseeing the thinkers.
We give them, we propose them 6 different sections of topics like economics, Europe, digital lifestyle, and we ask them what their opinion is about these topics, and they all have they're experts in their field. Most of them have already published a book.
Given that the average newspaper reader in Austria is aged around 45, traditional media are crucial to widening Denkt at Her's appeal, Klöckl says.
I do get the reactions of the people who read the text. It is already kind of an impact that the older generation sees that there are people from the younger generation who do think about the future and who do have ideas and that they are visible in the media.
Virgil Guggenberger agrees.
If something is in a newspaper, it's real. That's a problem. If it's in the newspaper, it's there. We have to talk about it. There's a meaning. There are positions which have some kind of street credibility.
Matthias Reisinger is one of Denkt at Her's thinkers.
I think a lot about where do we as a society head? What's the next evolutionary step of some of the models that we base our economy on? And so that's something that I hope to contribute to Denkt at Her.
Reisinger says Austria's system of government and mainstream public thinking are becoming obsolete.
look at Austria. I mean, how long are we able to continue as a country based on models that are very much rooted in the last 40, 50, 60 years? And then even in Austria, we see a rising number of people in poverty. We see a political system that really is in danger of failing because people are so disillusioned.
Massa Gaffari is also a thinker with Deng Tate. She highlights another thorny issue in today's Austria.
I've written one article until now. I wrote about the FPÖ, which is like the right-wing party in Austria, and they advertise right now for the elections, saying you have to love thy next or whatever. You know, like it's written in the Bible. But at the same time, they separate Austrians from non-Austrians and say like this social love or whatever is only meant to be for the Austrians.
Gaffari, who moved to Austria with her family from Iran, says FPÖ's slogan in the Vienna mayoral election campaign in 2010 was even more distressing.
Mehr Mut für unser Wiener Blut, zu viel Fremdes tut niemandem gut, which means we should be proud of our Viennese blood and too much foreigners is not good, like something like that. And that really disturbed me because like I would go to university or to work and walk past these things every day and it would just point me out as a foreigner, as something that is as a stranger in this country.
Milo Tesela says that debate platforms like Deng Tate are needed at all times, not just election times.
At least I can speak for Europe. There is a necessity for public debate. There's certainly the moment that we have to start to discuss how we want to live. Therefore, I see a lot of sense in Deng Tate to be a permanent project.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And we're going to stay in Austria for our music. This is Clara Moto with Disposable Darling. From Austria, that was Clara Moto with Disposable Darling. You're tuned in to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we go, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the producers of this evening's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily, Daphne Dinney and Annabelle Bly, alive on your radio waves. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Rob.
It's going to be fine. We've got literally 6 minutes. All we've got to do is we're going to talk about what's happening. Who's doing what? Daphne, are you doing the Globalist Asia?
No, I'm doing the Daily. You got it wrong.
I was going to say in that order. All right, Annabelle, let's start with you because that's at, what time is that? 2000 hours?
Yep, 2000 hours London time.
We're in the army now, aren't we?
We are.
So let's talk like we are.
In fact, our first story is military related.
Is it? Is that a seg? Have we segged from one neatly to another?
Very.
So we've got a military, we've got a considerable military bearing.
Yeah, we'll be talking about America's Asia pivot. So despite the fact that affairs in the Middle East have been dominating headlines, the fact is the 21st century is set to be America's Pacific century. And kind of reflective of that, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is in Seoul at the moment, and he'll be joined by John Kerry this week in Japan, and then Obama is set to meet them next week in Asia as well.
We were discussing in Obama's UN speech that he only mentioned Asia once, but the pivot is going to happen nonetheless, right?
Yeah.
Other people are doing it for him, Chuck and John.
I mean, the whole world is important. But,
so that's cool. And then, what else have we got after the Asia pivot? America's Asia pivot.
Well, it is the Globalist Asia, so we like to keep things fairly focused in that region.
Time zone.
But we'll be talking a little bit about Israel and China's tech scene. So Israel has a huge number of startups, and China's wealthiest man, Li Ka-shing, is investing in a huge Israeli tech university to try and bring some of that tech brilliance to China.
That sounds like a good idea. He's not nicking it. He's investing in it.
Yeah, he's giving them money. And hoping that they'll bring...
I'm going to steal that idea. That sounds quite good. That might be quite good in the magazine.
Yeah.
Just saying. So that's the Globalist Asia, and that's coming on at 8 o'clock UK time.
Yes.
Cool. Thanks. And then, Daphne, what have we got in the Monocle Daily?
Well, we're dealing with a rather serious subject, actually, an attack in Yemen in an army base and by Al-Qaeda. And that segs into the cover of the New York Times this weekend, which was about how Al-Qaeda's electronic communications has dropped really sharply since the attack in the Yemeni embassy was unveiled and sort of prevented. So basically, we're trying to understand, you know, how the US intelligence is now following Al-Qaeda. That's going to be our first item. So that's it's going to be quite long. We're going to speak to three people, someone in Yemen, and Robert Fox, the editor of the Evening Standard here in London, will be with us. And a New York Times reporter will also be on the line with us. So tune in for that. It's going to be quite interesting.
So that's our big top of the hour story.
That's our big
top of the hour
story.
That's at 10 o'clock, isn't it?
Indeed, yeah.
So, I always get the timings wrong. I mean 2200 London time.
I know you listen to our shows every night. So,
I know too.
Yeah.
And what else have we
the
got?
Second
We've got
story,
Yemen. What else do we have, Daphne?
The second story is about an object that you really like, and I know that you really like it. The BlackBerry.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm sure mine's been across more, it's been thrown across more restaurants and offices than most other forms of mobile communication, but yeah.
It's not a very nice way to show your BlackBerry that you like it, but I will not comment
on that.
Tough
love, definitely.
Sure. Anyway, the Globe and Mail from Toronto has unveiled a big investigation into how BlackBerry became uncool. So I'm sorry to tell you, Rob, that your BlackBerry is perhaps not as cool as you thought it was.
I put a sticker on mine, that made it instantly cool. We're going to have to leave it there. Daphne Denis produces the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 at this time, I think, 10 o'clock. And Annabelle Bly produces the Globalist Asia, which is on at 8 o'clock. Ladies, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we've got time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, George Brock, author of Out of Print, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by James Bullock and Matt Alagaya, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Next off the headlines is Culture, presented by... I don't know who that might be. It might be me. Here's a taste of what's to come.
We be made to laugh and we be made to be touched by the songs in some cases. And then suddenly, wham, it's a horror.
And that was Robin Hardy, director of The Wicker Man, which is out in its final cut form in cinemas right now. At 2000 hours, we'll have the Globalist Asia 2200, because it's written down, I can read it, the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, I've been Robert Bounds. Thanks for tuning in.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.